When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm trying to elevate small talk to medium talk.
Hi, I'm Alexander Chester, and Av, let's not go overboard. You're smarter than I think you are, but you're not really smart, though.
Fuck!
Yes, I knew it.
Because I'm Av Sadunsky, and Alex, you're no genius.
Welcome back to Pretty, Pretty, Pretty Good, a Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. I thought there was a decent chance we were going to match this week on that. We are here today to discuss Season 12, Episode 8, The Colostomy Bag, which originally aired on March 24th, 2024. And right off the bat, I will say this is an episode that rewards a second viewing right from the very first scene. I thought on my first viewing, I didn't like pick up on anything. And on the second viewing, I'm like, oh, that's who that guy is. And oh, that's why that guy's doing that. And so this is an episode where, like it or not, and we can get into whether we like it, we'll hear whether people who submitted to the postman like it. I do think it's an episode that rewards a second viewing. And I took a lot of notes on my second viewing, so glad to get into all of that if now is the time to do so.
Yes, I think it is. Let's jump into it, Alex. We only need to do three more of these, so let's take it all in. Let's cherish the episode and make the best of it.
Yeah, only two left after this week.
That's right. When we sign off tonight, there's only going to be one more and then the finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So let's not let it pass us too quickly. So, we start off with Larry, and he is heading to his lawyer's office, as we'll soon learn, and he parks his car in the garage, where he is welcomed by a valet, and Larry
So it's interesting because I think on my first viewing, the only thing I noticed in this scene was that he was singing that song, and I thought that was the focus of the scene. Mm-hmm. And then when he pauses and looks at the man that we will later learn to be Victor, and looks at him then stops singing, I thought it was because, oh, now I'm around other people, and I'm suddenly self-aware that I'm singing out loud, and I look kind of weird. But the singing has absolutely nothing to do with the plot at all. And on the second viewing, as you were saying, as I interrupted you, yes, it's he tosses the keys to the valet. And again, I didn't pick up on any of this, but the valet smiles and points back at Larry, who does the smile point back in return. Right. So these are two people who very clearly, and I didn't notice this on my first viewing, but
they're very intrigued.
Very clearly have a camaraderie, a previous relationship. Larry is doing absolutely nothing wrong.
I don't know if they have a previous relationship, but everything is being done above board with full consent, with full excitement. No issue here at all. One were to argue that Larry's behavior is like not appropriate or like requires a willing participant of some sort, you can't just assume that somebody's into that, which I'll disagree with. This guy clearly is on board.
For sure. 100%. Rodrigo is into it.
He's so into it. And again, it's a very harmless activity, as we'll get into.
Mm. Obviously, you are a tosser.
Yeah. Well, I'm not. I'm just, pro-choice when it comes to tossing. So we'll make our way into the lawyer's office. And we have what's a mock courtroom set up for Larry to kind of do a dry run on the witness stand.
Yeah, and what is with his ridiculous acting performance? whoa! Like, what is he doing? Like, with that the stuttering and the dramatic speaking and the joke cracking.
I mean, you don't think this is exactly how Larry David would behave when given an opportunity to speak in front of a room? Like,
true. When he spoke to the judge, he ended up talking about the lowly donkey.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess so. Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Yeah, I think this is completely. I think it's actually very good that this lawyer has realized that he needs to do this, because otherwise he'll put him up there and he's just going to go start telling incriminating stories. Just
for
like
sure.
He did to
yes.
the. You just got pulled over by a cop last episode,
for
and he committed.
Sure. Yes.
He confessed to crimes left and right.
Yeah, there is something, I don't know if meta is the right term, but you know, I've frequently noted on this show that like Larry will very frequently have a good and brief explanation for his behavior, but instead will provide the least charitable version of his own position. And as we approach the end of the show, it looks as if Larry could go to jail for doing just that very thing, because yes, he's on the stand at a criminal trial, a mock criminal trial here, with a potentially serious consequence. And he's going on about cordiality and piano lessons. And it's like, I'm almost as confused the tangents that he's going on as listeners to this podcast probably are the tangents that we go on. It's like, how did they get here? What's happening exactly?
Yeah. Why is Larry talking about Hitler? Mantle calls timeout. And Larry's like, what are you talking about? I'm doing a great job. I was ripping that prosecutor to shreds.
Yeah.
Mantle's like, all right, enough for today. Like, everyone, you know, jury, you can go home. And Larry wants to let him know that his father fought at the Battle of Iwo Jima. He wasn't one of the soldiers that was holding the flag, but he was very encouraging to those who were holding the flag. He cheered them on. He encouraged them. So he's a hero in his own rights.
Yeah. Now, we have to discuss the law firm that Mr. Christopher Mantle works for, because its name is on the wall. And I immediately noticed the first name. We'll get into it in a second. And our listener and attorney, I believe, Allie L. Or maybe let's keep her anonymous. We'll call her A. Lasher. She noticed it. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if she wants to be out of that way. You know, she likes to keep professional Allie and independent Allie, in separate. Anyways, the point is.
Well, I'm going to leave this between the two of you.
Yeah. Now I'm already in trouble, I'm sure. The name of the firm is Kasowitz, Spalding, Mantle, and Porter. Kasowitz is the name of a law firm based here in New York, Kasowitz Benson Torres, I believe, which is known most prominently nowadays for its very Trumpy associations. And I don't think that it was a firm or would be a firm that anyone outside of like the New York legal community would have ever heard of, but for the Trumpiness.
Yeah, no, so it was like a very big New York firm, but I think they don't even have offices really in other places.
Yeah, so like the showbiz comedy people behind, in L.A., behind the show of Curb, unless they're particularly upset with its Trumpiness, it would seem to me to just be a complete coincidence. But it's not a pretty specific name to be a coincidence. So I assume they're making some kind of Trumpy reference of some sort here.
I guess, or maybe it was just in their head, because it's not like the other firms that they go to use, which are Arnold and Porter and Spalding. My wife used to work at King and Spalding.
If there is something related to Kasowitz that I think we will discover then in the next two episodes, although maybe not because he got fired. So, but Allie, as I said, she took great notice, not just of the first name, but she went deeper. I really only looked at the Kasowitz of it. We have to look at the middle names, the last name. So we get Spalding, Mantle, and Porter. Mantle, of course, is for our friend Christopher, who is a name partner at this firm, despite being, based on what we've seen so far, one of the worst attorneys in America.
I bet he would be a name partner if his name was Zeckelman.
Yeah. You think about Kasowitz, Zeckelman. They already got the Jew in Kasowitz. So that leaves Spalding and Porter. So Allie noted that Spalding is the second name of King and Spalding. Here, I guess it's Kasowitz and Spalding. So I'm not really familiar with that.
King and Spalding and Arnold and Porter, I think, are both Atlanta-based firms.
So King and Spalding is headquartered in Atlanta. That is a good observation by you. So we have previously discussed that.
As I said, my wife worked there, so I know.
Yes. Okay, so that's good. Oh, you didn't have to Google it like I did. But in Mr. Mantle's previous appearance on the show, we discussed that he does not strike us as a Georgia lawyer. But I guess you could argue, no, he is a Georgia lawyer. He works for a Georgia-based firm. He works primarily in the LA office, but he goes back and forth between Georgia and California. One would wonder, there's probably not too many Georgia litigants in California as there are in Georgia. And there are certainly many fewer, I would argue zero, in fact, Georgia state courts in California. So not sure why a Georgia litigator would have an office in L.A. But anyway, that's part of the name. And then we get to Porter, which is Arnold
and Porter does not have anything.
It has nothing to do with anything. Yeah, nothing to do with
that with somebody else.
Yeah, nothing to do with Atlanta, nothing to do with anything that I could figure out. So I'm assuming that Spalding and Porter at the very least were just random, and maybe Kasowitz was in their heads because of Trump. I what do I know? But Allie, we discussed it, and we appreciate your keen observations there.
Oh, I'm thinking of Alston and Byrd, I think.
Oh, yeah. Alston and Byrd sounds much more Southern to me.
Yeah, I think that's a Georgia
firm. Both Alston and Byrd were probably on the wrong side in the Civil War. Yeah, they can wear a mean seersucker suit. Anyway, all right. So yeah, so Chris is here talking to Larry, trying to work with him on improving his testimony performance, and then he interrupts this meeting with his client to look at a text from his husband, which we learn says nothing of importance. Just continues to be a great lawyer all around. Chris doing a great job here.
Yeah, and Larry is very upset because he thinks that the guy who earlier saw him toss the keys and kind of like made a face, he was one of the people on the jury. And he thinks that he is going to poison everybody against him because he doesn't like him. He doesn't like that Larry tossed the keys. And Larry would like to have this guy removed from the jury.
Yeah. And this is, again, sort of a classic example of Curb, someone jumping to a conclusion with scant evidence, but they are proven to be completely correct.
Yeah. If only this was Coram, he might be able to pull that off.
Yeah. Now, but he did, again, on the second viewing, you notice that him and Larry are making angry eyes at or suspicious eyes at each other throughout the mock trial performance.
Yeah. So this is where Larry, you know, sees the text. He confirms that, you know, oh, you're back together. They worked it out. And yeah, you gave him the Zekelman, didn't you? And Chris confirms. So back down in the garage, Larry goes up to Rodrigo and he's like, so, hey, I just want to like make sure, like, are you OK with me tossing the keys to you? Like, is there any problem? And Rodrigo's like, no, like, why would I mind? That would be a crazy thing to say. And
again, if you had to grade Larry's behavior, give it a letter grade in terms of courteousness, friendliness, etc., what would you give it?
A minus.
Oh, I was going to say A plus. He's perfect. He's been completely perfect here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he could be a little bit nicer, but yeah, he's doing very well. He's doing completely fine. He's going like over the top to make sure that this like valet guy is comfortable with the way that his keys were delivered to him.
Doesn't even have to get up to get the car. Gets a big tip. Larry's being like, he's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So Larry's going to head over to Jeff, and on the way, he sees Conan just strolling on the streets.
And this is all we get of Conan in this first scene. Do you remember the time when Michael Scott was in New York in the office and Conan walked by? Also wearing a brown leather jacket.
And it was like specifically like Michael Scott like thinks he sees a celebrity.
Yeah.
But it was just like a black person like that was not a celebrity. And then like the documentarian like is like telling him and he's like, what? Who was it? He was right here?
Yeah. Exactly. So that's sort of, that's what I thought of here. But I know, of course, we will get more Conan. But then we get to Jeff's house. And I got to say, this really, 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 really annoyed me. This rubbed me the wrong way. So the whole story here is premised on the fact that Jeff's back is so bad that he has to get surgery that might kill him or leave him in a coma, right? We have seen Jeff walking, flying, golfing, fucking, living his normal life. In fact, he just had to sit in an economy middle on a cross-country flight, was desperately looking for excuses to get out of it, and never once mentioned that his bad back could be hurt by sitting in that situation for that many hours. Now suddenly his back is so bad and has been for so long that he has exhausted all other avenues because surgery is always like the last step in this situation that he's forced to back surgery. So it's annoyingly stupid to me because it would have cost Curb nothing to throw in a random reference to Jeff's back anywhere earlier this season just to establish the smallest part of credibility to the story. And it would pay off so much here, and they didn't. And it's just like a little bit of laziness, and it's a little disappointing to me.
Yeah, I hear you.
And then also Jen, by the way, completely and angrily rejected the Jeff saying that there's a 3% chance that the anesthesia will go bad. So, yeah. But I will say, I did laugh really hard when he said, maybe on the way there we get into a fight, which is more than likely. And then, like, the whole thing about Jeff saying, you don't even have to visit me, and I was laughing. So I did like that. But the premise of the scheme just annoys me that it's sort of out of nowhere.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Okay, so...
And by the way, my other issue here is Jeff being concerned that Susie would pull the plug to get his money we had a similar circumstance in season five. At the end of season five, Larry's on the precipice of heaven after giving Lewis the kidney, floating above his body, looking down, and he sees Cheryl and Jeff, by the way, immediately fighting over his money before he's even totally gone. So again, a little curb repeating itself here a little bit with, but again, I'm sure not too many people there even remember that at this point. But I do want to follow through on the scheme, on the specifics of the scheme, because I don't even understand it. So if Susie doesn't find out, that means that Jeff is fine. The surgery went okay. We're fine. The power of attorney wasn't needed, correct?
Okay.
But now let's assume that Jeff is not fine, right? Which the power of attorney. Yeah, the power of attorney is necessary. So Susie thinks she has power of attorney, goes to speak to the doctors. The doctors look at the official forms and they say, sorry, Susie, but we're bringing an LD from the pen here. At this point, she would be insanely livid. But Jeff, luckily for him, is in a coma or whatever, right. So he can't be the target. But Larry would be the target of just unmitigated ire. And so it just makes no sense why Larry would ever agree to this. Jeff doesn't care. He's not going to suffer. But for Larry, this is like insane levels of pain and frustration for no benefit.
Well, Jeff, not only is he not going to suffer, he gets the benefit of remaining alive.
Yeah, I just think that Larry has to put up more of an argument here before he just agrees to it.
Yeah, I mean, Larry's not thinking of the scenario where it's like legitimately the plug should be pulled. It's he wants to save his friend's life just in case his wife is going to try to kill him.
Well, I'm saying I don't think Larry's even thinking at all about the consequence of Jeff being in a of needing the power of attorney, period.
No, but
I'm
not afraid. He's not in a coma. That's the point. Like, he's not like Susie's going to take advantage and pull the plug on him. Like,
what I'm saying is, I don't think whatever circumstance there is that the power of attorney is necessary, I don't think Larry's taking into account the fact that Susie will be so mad at him and will make his life so miserable that there's no reason he should agree to this. It's much worse than having to be like the surrogate dad to that kid from last episode, Olivia, for the next 60 years, right? Like one fight with Susie is worse than like, you know, how long is Larry going to live anyways? Another 20 years? All right, so for 20 years, he's got to follow this kid around, you know, send him a text every week or whatever. So that's my take here. I just think that Larry has to object more. And then the other annoying thing is they're having this conversation in the house where Susie could be, right? Like, in fact, Susie will overhear them say that they can't let her find out. And it's just, given her history with these two, including the dream scheme, which was, again, just last week, there's no chance in hell that she'd walk into a room here, don't let Susie find out, and then would believe their little act out is like that it's about the mock trial. So it just, Susie's behavior here is very, the whole thing, it just, it's very clunky to me.
Yeah. So Larry, and I love that she's like plotting to kill him in Jeff's like fear. It's that like she's gonna get annoyed about something petty the day before.
Yeah. So, yeah, be less motivated to keep him alive. Yeah, that makes sense.
So Larry's like, okay, fine, but Susie could find out because they're gonna know, she's gonna hear that we visited the lawyer's office. I don't know how she'll know that, but fine.
Yeah.
And Jeff says, no, we got the perfect cover. My lawyer works in the same building as Mantle. So we'll just say we were going to see Mantle for you. And she won't know that I went to see my lawyer.
Yeah.
As
if they're not hanging out together all day, every day anyway.
Yeah. And then like proof of like how like these idiots are just going to get caught immediately anyway. So why even bother? Larry says, yeah, she'll never find out as Susie walks in. And she's like, never find out what?
Yeah. Yeah. So stupid. Yeah, so then they turn it into telling the story about the mock trial, and again, also,
just to add on to that, like it's completely insane that like with regard to Susie, Jeff or Larry would ever utter the words "she'll never find out."
Yes,
like exactly. How many times have they said those exact? Yeah,
exactly. She always finds out. But so Larry starts giving the story about the trial. And every time he tells the key tossing story, he just makes himself sound as bad as possible. He could very accurately say, and more partially to his own cause, I have a good rapport with the valet there. We toss the keys back and forth. We point at each other. We smile. Instead, he does make himself sound like a big shot. So, you know, I don't blame Susie for being against him. I don't blame Victor for being against him. He makes himself out to be like the worst possible way every time he tells a story.
Yeah, well, that's just classic Larry.
Yeah.
But it's like a similar... you know, detriment is like kind of what we were saying about like the way he's gonna riff on the stand. Like he's his own worst enemy when he's allowed to talk.
Yes.
Like in defense of himself. Like, yes. he'll paint himself in the worst possible light. He'll go on tangents. He'll say things that are incriminating, that he should have just not said anything. This is just who he is. Like, he needs to, like, just telegraph, you know, just say out loud all of his inner thoughts.
Yeah. And last week was a rare exception, where both he and Freddie, the moment they got to yes for the flop, they were immediately out. They didn't keep talking and get into more trouble. It's like, all right, I'll see you later. I got what I wanted. But yeah, Larry normally does not do that. But Susie, of course, anti-Larry, as she always is, she thinks you can hurt someone by tossing the keys around. And Larry responds, what kind of mutant can't catch a key? And we know for certain that we will see that mutant by the end of the episode, and that mutant will probably be Larry.
correct. So Larry gets a call from Lewis, and we find out that Lewis has long COVID, which...
Yeah.
This is so out of date that, like, long COVID isn't even a thing. Although I guess some people will claim that.
No, I know some people who, yeah, still don't have a sense of smell.
I agree that there's some people who think that they have long COVID.
Yeah.
And they all wear masks and hate Jews. And
no, I'm not even talking. No, you don't know anybody who, like, still doesn't have a sense of smell? We have mutual friends.
Yes. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah. I lost my sense of smell, actually, like, during the pandemic, but not because of COVID. and then it came back because I started taking my shots.
Because you went to Switzerland to get the surgery.
Is that the Kobe surgery?
No, that's what Richard will say later in the episode.
Oh.
Yeah. But Larry really is the ultimate come with guy. Jeff asks him to come with on an absolutely absurd assignment, but to be fair, one where he's one of the few people can actually do it. But the consequences are very bad, and he agrees. Richard asks him to come with on another absurd assignment, much easier, less bad consequences, but also could be done by any person with a working nose. But again, Larry agrees. So he really is such a great come-with guy.
He trusts Larry.
Yeah.
So before heading out, Larry's like, oh, I don't want to, like, carry this around. I have this block of Vonderdong cheese that I bought earlier today. Can I leave it here in your fridge? I don't want this to get my car. Like, I'll get it from you tomorrow. And Susie says, that's my cheese now.
Yeah. Why'd they make up a cheese? Why didn't they just say the name of an actual cheese?
Well, I think, first of all, the word Vonderdong is very funny to say.
Okay, yeah. But there's a lot of funny name cheeses, aren't there?
Yeah, I don't know why they couldn't use a real cheese. It's a good question. So Larry goes over to meet Lewis and check out this Mercedes. And he's like, by the way, I ran into Conan. But I didn't want to go up and talk to him because I don't want him to think I'm nuts.
Yeah. So, gonna have to go on a rant here.
Okay. Please.
So number one, it is absolutely impossible in the world of Curb Your Enthusiasm that Conan and Larry have not crossed paths. Larry was a comedian in New York in the 80s. He used to work on Saturday Night Live. He ended up creating an incredibly famous and popular comedy show on NBC throughout the 90s. Conan was a comedian in New York just a few years later. He went to work on Saturday Night Live just a few years later. Saturday Night Live alumni are famously chummy. They see each other at events and reunions and whatnot. Then Conan worked on NBC through the 90s, hosting a comedy show. They almost certainly would have seen each other at award shows and upfronts and everything else like that. Even if Curb Larry wasn't famous enough at the time to appear on Conan's show, not that Conan's show was bringing, like, top talent in the early years, but whatever. Certainly, post-Seinfeld, Curb Larry has only become more famous. He was prominently involved with the Seinfeld reunion. He starred in a Broadway show while planning another Broadway show, which he spoke about on late-night talk shows, by the way. He was targeted with a global fatwa. He opened up a spite store that became nationally famous and inspired other celebs to get into the action. And now, most recently, he's a political hero for standing up against Georgia's racist voter intimidation laws and is on all the news channels. So, and Larry's oldest and best friend, Richard, has been friends with Conan for years. So it's not possible that Curb Larry and Conan don't know each other. But even if somehow they didn't, even if we're in a world like where somehow everything I just mentioned, somehow by some crazy coincidence they've never met, if they did meet, Conan wouldn't think of Larry as some crazy nut who needs clearance. He'd think of Larry as the guy who did all the things that I just mentioned. So it's just in the world of the show, the setup is impossibly dumb, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree with all of that. And I think even without all of the, like, very direct connections between the two of them, this whole thing is still extremely stupid. Like, if, like, let's say, like, Larry had been on an ABC show in the 80s, so just, like, they were never, like, crossing paths, like, he's still famous enough that, like, he shouldn't be so intimidated that, like, he can't even, like, share the same breathing space as Conan O'Brien unless he's been granted permission.
this is the biggest guest star that we've ever had. He needs clearance beyond every other celebrity. Shaq, Martin Scorsese, Hugh Hefner, Michael right. Bloomberg, whatever. In Larry's estimation, none of these people require in the slightest the type of deference that he thinks Conan requires.
And that Richard Lewis will provide.
Yes.
It's not like he's getting Jerry Seinfeld to make a call for him.
For sure, yes. Richard Lewis, who's much, much less famous. I will say this. The idea of needing clearance, a buffer of sorts, before talking to someone you think is a bit out of your league, that concept does absolutely resonate with me. I think it's a funny idea. And Conan does love to play like the over-the-top blowhard. So like he could be cast well in this circumstance. But Larry David can't be the other party here because it doesn't make sense. The Larry to Conan relationship is the part of it that doesn't work, even though I was excited to see it because I'm a huge Conan fan. And let's get to the Ted Danson Club right now.
Would you stop with the Ted Danson?
Who's he?
He's somebody.
What about me?
You're nobody.
Why him? Why not me?
He's good. You're not.
I'm better than him.
You're worse. Much, much worse.
In my mind, there's absolutely no question that Conan belongs in the Ted Danson Club. Yeah. And I was preparing to come in with data points to cite in case you disagreed, but now that's clearly unnecessary because the show itself is announcing that this is the highest right. profile guest we've ever had.
That's right. That's the plot.
Yeah. Even if he's obviously famous for being a late night talk show and stuff, just host, but because of how he looks, I think he's much more noticeable than like a Jimmy Kimmel or whatever. He's not Shaq level, but he's one of the most sort of unique looking people because he's 6'6" and has a wild, you know, bouffant of red hair or whatever. So
and his name is Conan.
Yes. Or Conan, as Akiva calls him.
Conan. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was working like, I think it was a summer job. When the whole like Leno and Conan and the whole like whatever thing, you know,
the late night wars, yes,
it was all going down, and the person, one of the people I shared an office with, he would always call him Conan, and it was very annoying,
yeah,
because that's we were like all talking about all day,
yeah. Oh, and by the way, this is another example, like Larry thinking he needs clearance. It's not that Conan told him you got a clearance. Larry, before he's even spoken to him, preemptively thinks he needs clearance, which is another example of the curve trope of something that sort of is unrealistic and doesn't make sense, but turns out to be, you know, confirmed as correct.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we also talk about it more when we actually get to the scene, but it's like, it's one thing for like, fine, maybe this thing of clearance exists. Maybe it specifically exists for Conan. Like Larry knows that like Conan just like, doesn't like, you know, this is just the way he is. But like for Conan to like be openly talking about this, like unironically is just like, it's insane behavior.
Yeah. I have more to say about that scene when we get to that scene.
Let's hold off.
We're in the car and Larry tells Richard that he only really has a good nose for bad smells, not for the good ones.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that was part of my experience. I was not smelling for a little while there, probably about 6 months to a year. Smelling's overrated. Like,
well,
there's some good smells. There's a lot of bad smells. It's kind of a wash.
So I want to propose a hot take to you. And I'm sure there's some medical reasons why you need your smell, sense of smell for balance or some other bullshit, but whatever. Leaving that.
Like, there could be safety situations.
Sure, yeah. But I would argue, let's ignore all that for a second, that the sense of smell is a net negative. Like, every other sense is obviously a huge positive. If you lost it, you would be devastated. But the loss of smell, like, why is that so bad? You just said you went right out. Like, all right, yeah. So there's many good smells. You didn't get to smell flowers. You didn't get to smell, maybe not you, but, like, I would miss the smell of my wife's hair or my children, but like that pleasure is not canceled out by the horrificness of like a situation where you can't avoid a bad smell. Like imagine you're sitting next to a BO monster on a 7-hour flight. You question life itself. It's a miserable experience. You're trying to put your nose in your sweatshirt, but you're not trying to be awkward, rude about it. It's misery. There's no equivalent with the other senses, right? If you see something you don't like, you can close your eyes or look away. Like it's scent is inescapable when it's bad. So
yeah, I was in a situation. We were in a car driving somewhere, and I think either somebody threw up or whatever. I don't remember exactly. And everyone was complaining. I was like, I'm fine.
So if you were,
let's continue. Like, why are we still alive?
If you were buying a car and you were concerned, who would you use as your nose guy or girl?
I mean, I'd probably just use my wife. She's probably
she have a good nose. Yeah.
I think she's a regular nose.
Richard doesn't have one of those, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So let's get to Steve Buscemi, who's selling the car here.
So yeah, obviously his nose.
Yeah. Yes. Now he has no sense of smell at all. I love Steve Buscemi. He does not look good here, although that's probably intentional, given the character, like DiCarlo. It wasn't clear to me
he's
at
lucky
first.
He's sharing scenes with Richard Lewis.
Yes. It wasn't clear to me at first if this guy is just like a random stranger or a guy in their social circles, this DiCarlo. I think it's pretty clear that he's in their social circle because, first of all, they refer to him as DiCarlo, not like that guy. Jeff right. seems to know him also.
Right. They're able to get information about him.
Yeah. The theater, like, yeah, he tells, talks to Larry.
Very
the theater,
specific
yeah.
information.
Yeah. He tells Larry that he's an asshole, which, you know, although you could meet Larry once and think that also. He says he's getting rid of the car because he's going through a divorce and doesn't want his wife to get the car. Won't you get half the value if he sells it, or am I just underestimating sort of the pettiness and spite when people are getting divorced? Probably.
Yeah, you're probably underestimating.
Yeah, but like, this bitch has got to be pretty terrible, like real Irma Kostrowski vibes to be breaking up with a man who's going through a health crisis.
Yeah, well, sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah.
She promised herself she'd never do that again.
Mm-hmm. Could it be Irma? You think he got married to Irma? Be a pretty quick turnaround for Irma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Larry checks out the car. He thinks it smells like cigarettes. And Lewis tells Buscemi that he wants a $3,000 discount on the car. Smell discount.
Yeah.
And Buscemi's
three
like,
seems pretty low.
Do we know what the full price here is?
No, I'm going to guess $25,000.
Should we look up how much a 1973 Mercedes is?
Yeah. Now, the weird thing is that they imply that it's perfect inside and out other than the smell. Richard says that. But apparently, Richard does not go on a test drive. He just does a test sit because he doesn't notice that the seatbelt is broken. He doesn't know that you have to keep your foot on the gas when you're at red lights. So I'm not exactly sure how good the condition is and if that affects the Blue Book value here.
It does. So in excellent condition, according to conceptcars.com.
Mm-hmm.
A 1973 Mercedes-Benz 450 SL is worth $11,375.
Oh, I was way too high. Okay.
Yeah, that's in excellent condition.
Yeah.
In good condition, it's worth $7,000.
Oh, so $3,000 for smell discount's a big discount then.
Yeah, it's like half price.
Yeah, okay. All right, okay.
Well, so maybe... here I see a little, on a different side, I'm seeing a little bit higher, but still under 20.
Okay, so Richard's being a little bit aggressive here.
Well, if it's 20, $3,000 isn't... is a reasonable discount, I think. If it's going to smell, I mean, although it's like you can get that cleaned or fixed, right?
Well, I don't know. We had this in Seinfeld and you couldn't even get it out of the hair.
If it's cigarette smoke, like that'll go away.
In Seinfeld, it was BO.
Oh, but maybe not. Maybe it's like, because it gets like in the upholstery.
Yeah. I mean, if they could get rid of it, he would have gotten rid of it. I'm sure that it's baked into that fabric.
Unless it's his and he's a smoker and like, he doesn't care. So.
Well, he's not the only one who's owned that car over the last 50 years.
Right, but maybe he's the most recent owner, and yeah, he's the one that smell like cigarettes.
Yeah, there was a reference to the Chesterfields, but yeah.
Anyway, he says take it or leave it, and Lewis says leave it. You know, he's coming, and Buscemi's like, oh my God, this is the worst day. And Larry's like, well, let's look on the bright side. It could be even worse if you had a colostomy bag.
Yeah, which is such a weird thing to say. It's not just that it's potentially offensive. Do you remember, like, what was it? Was it in episode one of the show? Or it was early in season one when Larry's talking to Jeff's black lawyer and he makes some joke about affirmative action?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, like, that's offensive. But, like, this one is, I guess, slightly less potentially offensive because, you know, the percentage of people with colostomy bags is low. But it makes no sense. Like, why would he have said colostomy bag of all things? Like, why was that even in his head? Again, plant a seed. Yeah. Say, have Jeff reference that he's worried that he could be in a colostomy bag because of the back surgery.
Right.
Give us some context here.
Yeah, it's very bizarre.
Especially when you're named the whole episode.
Yeah, DiCarlo looks like a ghost when Larry says this.
Yeah.
And on the way back, like, Larry's like asking Lewis, like, do you know anything? Like, does he have a colostomy bag? He seemed very upset. And Lewis has no idea, so Larry decides to ask Jeff and see if Jeff knows anything.
Yeah.
I don't think we find out till later, right?
No, not yet. Yeah, we'll get a text. We can get into the text messages that are sent, but that's not till we get to the lawyer's office.
Okay, so yeah, at the lawyer's office, we are greeted now on the way by Victor, who, in addition to being a very angry member of the jury, is also a valet.
Yeah.
Now it makes a little bit more sense why he takes this so personally, I guess.
Yes, and we learn out that there are two kinds of people in the valet world: handers and tossers.
Handers and tossers.
Yeah.
You like to get a hand job, you like to have your salad tossed.
interesting. I didn't think about it like that. It is weird to me that Larry in this scene tells Victor, a guy he knows doesn't like him, I'm going to sign some papers to kill my friend whenever I want to. A fact that Larry wants to be kept secret from certain people.
Right.
It's very strange, especially because Larry has a record with the guy who made the tombstone, for example, or the shucker, of accidentally saying things in front of these random laborers who overhear it and then the secret and then use it against him. So I certainly thought it would come back to bite him during my first watch, but it does not.
It does not.
Victor will get at him, but in a different way.
Yeah. So Victor is like, you know, he's being very argumentative with Larry, you know, and he tells him, I bet if you were a valet, you wouldn't like having this like big shot move done to you. And Larry's like, that's nonsense. I would love having keys tossed back to me. And when I return the car, I'll toss the keys and be handed a tip. So yeah, Larry doesn't agree with this at all. He thinks he would love to have keys tossed to him. He loves to toss. He loves to receive tosses. It's just more fun when you toss. Now, I don't think I toss. I don't really see any problem with the toss.
Yeah, I've never tossed. Do you ever see the movie Go?
Yeah, of course.
So remember when they get to Vegas, and Taye Diggs, I think, the black actor? He's wearing like a yellow sport jacket.
Black actor. I don't know if he's
whoever, some guy tosses him the keys to his car thinking he's a valet. And then and Larry once almost had an awkward situation like that on this show, of course, in front of Wanda. But by the way, I was looking up names of cheeses earlier. I forgot to mention this to you. There's a cheese called Timberdoodle, a semi-soft rectangular cheese with a sticky orange rind and a creamy center made from cow's milk and Taleggio style. So Timberdoodle, there's a lot of funny named cheeses out there. I don't know why they didn't make a Fondre Donk. But anyway, so back to the tossing. Yeah. So when I think of tossing keys to a valet, that's what I think of in the movie Go. So Larry seems like he's does not win this interaction with Victor.
Yeah, no, he does not. Yeah. So we're there to sign the POA documents, and Larry is taking a very aggressive move towards the Leica gambit. Yeah.
Now I do like the callback.
It's weird that they're doing it again with a pen, though.
Yeah. Well, it's lower stakes. I mean, listen, Larry was the one who claimed that it would work 50% of the time.
Leon did, but he already got Ted Danson's pen this way.
Yeah, and we were very doubtful of that success rate. But the way we previously saw it carried out, but here it certainly should have worked. It's insane. I mean, this lawyer's a bit of a dick for refusing it, especially since he notes how many he has, and given how much he's probably billing Jeff for this work. Take the pen. Yeah. He also says you can buy it at the department store. Like, who buys pens at department stores in 2024?
Any department store. Yeah, no, it's not what you can do with Amazon.
Yeah, this lawyer really has zero sense of humor or charisma at all. And so, given that, it kind of surprises me that with a straight face, he says, you know, I have power of attorney. That is the power to pull the plug. Like, that's not something you say unless you're like a lawyer would say, unless he's trying to sort of be lighthearted. And this guy doesn't seem to have that vibe. So, and then I'm confused about the copy. So, if this is an original hard copy that has to be given to Jeff, right? Then why do they have to send it later, right? Like, what's the wait for? Both parties, Jeff and Larry, are here. They just signed everything. Just give it to them right now, unless you want to go scan a copy so you can keep an electronic copy in your office. But then you would say, I'll be back in 1 minute, not I'll send it to your house later, especially because Jeff and Larry sit there for over a minute chatting anyways. Like, they're not in a rush to leave. So I understand why for the story, why we need these to be sent from the lawyer's office, couriered over to Jeff's house, but it doesn't really make any sense in the scene.
Yeah. Also, it's a good time to do a rant about original signatures, which are the dumbest thing that exists.
Yeah. And aren't really necessary anymore.
Well, anything with like a bank is, and anything that's like a will or a power of attorney is still like, it's required to be an original signature. And it drives me crazy because an original signature is like much less reliable than a DocuSign.
Yes.
That's like exactly stamped by like the email that signed in, the time they signed it. Like it's completely authentic.
And yeah, it's very stupid.
Somebody that just scribbled whatever. It could be anybody.
Yeah. Very anachronistic. Very dumb. But the whole scene in the lawyer's office, it doesn't really make sense to me. I mean, why do they just sit there and keep chatting afterwards, Larry and Jeff? Isn't that kind of weird? Like, the lawyer doesn't escort them to like – the elevator, the receptionist. He just leaves him in his conference room where they just sit and chat.
He's going to charge them as long as they're there.
I guess so, yeah. But usually I feel like you escort your clients to... Anyway.
Yeah.
So I understand. They needed there to be a risk of Susie seeing the hard copy, but, you know, they didn't figure out a good way to get from here to there, I thought. And now Jeff's phone beeps, and he looks in his pocket to see that he got a text message, correct?
Yes.
Now, let's look at the text message. It's okay. We see the phone. It's 9:37 a.m. today.
Okay.
And it's a text message with a Jay Hornstock. And Jeff texted Jay Hornstock the message, "So what's the news with Mike?" at 9:37 a.m. today. Now, if you look in the corner of the phone, it is currently 9:37 a.m. today. Hornstock has texted back, "DiCarlo had stomach surgery a few months ago." Now, first of all, that's like a very oddly specific answer to an extremely generic question. Like, hey, what's going on with our friend? Like, months ago, like, number one. Number two, we were with Jeff.
Yeah, you know the answer, right?
Yeah. Jeff has not sent any texts in the last 60 seconds. We know that we were with him.
Because, yeah, the art department didn't, like, spend a lot of time on
that. I'm just saying, I'm disappointed.
He's probably just using his actual phone.
If this was a Roger Nygaard edited...
That's Jeff Garland's phone. Yeah. And somebody who works on Curb, whose name is whatever you said, texted him the thing about the stomach so that way they could just show that.
Yes. I'm just saying, a Roger Nygaard edited episode, this wouldn't have happened. Last week, we had the whole group chat scroll. And here, just, it was a sloppy job by the effects or props or whoever's responsible for Jeff's phone here.
What was the guy's name?
Jay Hornstock. Hornstock. One word. Hornstock. Yeah, I think it's a made-up name. I don't think it's anyone actually in the room. But anyway, yeah. So Larry's very upset, and he says, "What can I do for this guy?" And Jeff says, "I have no idea." And I'm screaming at the screen. Of course, you know what you can do. You can buy the car at the original price. That's the thing he wanted. That's what he's so upset about. And then since you don't want it and your friend Richard does, you'll turn around and give it to Richard and everyone will be happy. And you'll swallow the $3,000 price difference if Richard balks because that's the cost of making the bad Cosby bag joke. Like, this is an easily solvable problem. It's very clear how it's going to be solved. So I'm not sure why Larry and Jeff are so confused here.
Yeah.
So we go back to Jeff and Susie's house, and Susie is all of a sudden very skeptical. In the previous scene, she walked in on them conspiring not to let her find something out. She had no problems. Here, all they've done is walked in together, and she's got a whole lot of questioning. You're his manager. This isn't manager behavior. This isn't, like, what are you talking about? These guys do everything together for 25 years. As you frequently know, you just called them boyfriends. You just flew with them to Atlanta for a non-managerial activity. And so none of that makes sense. And then Jeff's like over-explanation, like, it's good I was there. It only went okay because of the few moments I was there. That's a ridiculous, overly defensive thing to say that makes no sense. So nothing in this scene makes any sense. Although it gets to the funny thing about, you know, Larry and Susie agreeing that Jeff isn't that smart. I like that.
Yeah.
So, I laughed very hard, I should say.
So now this is where Larry goes through the fridge and he's like, "Hey, where's my
keys?" Hold on, we have a frickin' Frack reference, which of course we have to acknowledge.
Oh, okay.
Yes, frickin' Frack were indeed, I looked it up, a pair of Swiss skaters who came to the United States for a tour in 1937.
Okay.
So, yes, let's get to the cheese.
Yeah, so Larry goes in the fridge and he's like, "What the hell, where's my cheese?" And Susie says, "Oh, I ate it." And Larry's like, "What do you mean you ate it? Like, I told you to just hold the cheese for me. I was going to come back the next day to pick it up." And Susie gets like all sanctimonious about how when you leave something somewhere, it now belongs to that person. Possession is 9/10 of the law. And Larry's like, "What's the other 10? Fucking over your friends and stealing their cheese?" And Jeff comes in. We find out Jeff also enjoyed some of the cheese. But yeah, this is just completely shameless, horrible behavior by the Greens here.
Yes, but I do think that the 9/10 possession stolen cheese, like, it's the funniest part of the episode. The problem is it was in the trailer for the episode that we saw last week, so that ruins it. Right. But yes, as you said, Jeff and Susie's behavior, unconscionable here. Also hard to believe they consumed that entire huge slab of cheese in just one day. Susie also says she made a melted cheese sandwich for Jeff. We just established that Susie won't let Jeff have sandwiches. He can only have salads. So she didn't have to make
also, like the Vonderdonk or whatever the hell we're calling this, it didn't look like the type of cheese that, like, you, like, put in, like, you know, like, melt into a sandwich.
Well, you could slice it. You get a cheese slicer. You cut slices. You put it on the bread. And yeah, you could. It's not the yes. It's for a fancier
It's like you eat it with melt, a cracker and whatever. Fruit and yeah.
Sure, maybe yeah. I do yeah, like
also, the like the whole like reference that like it'll come up with Manta later of like the law here. It's like the law is not applicable here. Like no one.
But
is
also
that, like,
hold on. Even if the law is applicable. Susie, like Larry has an oral, license agreement to use that shelf in the fridge. He says, can I store it here for one day? She says, yes. She right. can't take it during the one day legally. They have an oral agreement.
Yeah.
Yes.
And even if not, it's like, yeah, fine. You can't like prosecute her.
Yeah.
Like, under the law. That doesn't mean she's not an asshole.
A huge asshole. Yes. So this is Larry's completely in the – he's in the right with the valets. He's in the right with the cheese. He's in the right everywhere in this episode. It is wonderful, by the way. Susie tells Larry not to make a whole Megillah over this because, of course, Purim. The episode aired on Purim, which is the day that Jews read the famous Megillah Esther. So that was wonderful. I love Larry taking something back to get back for the Vonderdonk, but I think you got to go more expensive than, like, the half-empty pomegranate juice. I think you got to go for, like, you know – Take the clock. Yeah, take something of value because it's not just how much the cheese costs, but he had to schlep all the way to get it. So, yes. All right. So now let's get to Conan, right?
So as he walks out, he sees Conan again. And he goes over. He's like, hey, Conan! And Conan's like very awkward and like doesn't really want to talk to him. And Larry realizes, oh no, Lewis didn't get the clearance like he was supposed to. And Conan's like, yeah, no clearance. This kind of feels like an ambush. A person can't just walk up to another person and say hello.
Of course not.
Larry's like, I'm very apologetic. But of course, this doesn't prevent him from continuing forward with his, all sorts of Larryisms. And they have like a very funny back and forth about the phrase, I'll think about it. And Conan even appreciates the observation from Larry that people never mean it when they say, I'll think about it. He's like, yeah, I say all the time, I'll think about it, but I have no intention of thinking about it. I'm just trying to get out of the conversation. You would think the fact that, like, Larry's, like, being, like, funny and, like, friendly here would, like, Conan be like, oh, you know what, whatever, it's fine. We don't need clearance. You seem okay enough.
The whole scene is very inconsistent and frustrating to me. One of the things that we've been told repeatedly by guests on the show, and also not, even outside this podcast, it's been discussed, is that they're always told, don't try to be funny. Just be the straight man for Larry. Don't make jokes. The funny will emerge. If you force it, it's not good. But, like, Conan is being way too much of the straight man here. And considering how Conan usually acts, it's very hard to believe. Like, I love Conan. I'm a Conan completist. His podcast is the first one I listen to. I really, really love Conan a lot. But, like, for most of this scene, he's just playing this, like, weirdly dry, blah character. I do love when he says there's a reason the protocol's been around since early sound days, 32, 33. It's just him telling Larry to still talk to Lewis just doesn't make any sense, right? Like the reason to talk to Lewis is to break the ice, but the ice is already broken here, right? Like if Conan decides to grant the clearance, he can grant it right now. So it doesn't, they're trying to make a joke. It doesn't really work. Like, again, as I said this before, Conan wasn't expecting Larry to come, Richard to reach out to him. Right. From his perspective, none of this is happening. It's Larry who's initiating it. So I think the idea is finding the execution's a bit off. And then Larry makes a Fatty Arbuckle reference, which whatever credit he got from Conan for the observation about the think about it, he immediately loses here. And this to me is so unrealistic. Conan would love a Fatty Arbuckle reference. Like Conan is in heaven when people bring up old historic references. He's a huge history nerd. He himself just referenced the Titanic. He would have laughed uproariously at a Fatty Arbuckle reference. By the way, if he found out that Larry made a frickin' frack reference, he would love that also. So, as I watched this, it was just, sort of disappointing to me. I was just very shocked to see Conan's reactions throughout the scene. By the way, then Conan references Margaret Dumont. Do you know who that is, Alf?
No.
I think she must have broken a bottle over Fatty Arbuckle's head. But anyway, no. But the point is that I love Conan and I'm very disappointed with the logic and the behavior and the consistency and everything else. So very sad face for me here.
Yeah, so Larry compliments him on his Dalmatian, which he refers to as a firehouse dog.
Yes.
Conan is very offended. He thinks this is an unfair stereotype of Dalmatians. They don't all live in firehouses. Some of them live in Conan O'Brien's house, apparently. Conan walks away and he just tells him, call Lewis. You got to go through Lewis.
Yeah.
I only know you through Lewis.
So, we weren't really friends.
Yeah. So we go over to DiCarlo's house, and Larry wants to go apologize to Buscemi, and he ends up, because of feeling bad about the whole colostomy bag situation, and Buscemi really figures out what's going on here and like wants, you know, he like really milks it and plays it up. And Larry ends up buying the car. And this guy has Larry so over a barrel that not only is he buying the car from him at full price, when Larry's like, can you just give me a ride home after buying the car from you? He's like, nah, I don't feel like it. You'll figure it out. So Larry has to like drive him, that he's like, he's going to have to take an Uber back to get his other car.
Yeah.
And to make matters worse, when Larry gets into the car, he realizes that the seatbelt is broken. And he's like, well, this is, seems like highly, you know, not to code. And he's like, well, it's code in 1973, very different.
Yeah, Richard literally never did a test drive. Crazy.
Right. He never even sat on it.
Yeah, no, I do think Larry is being very rude to DiCarlo in the scene when he goes over the top. Like, if you can live with all your terrible shit going on, I can buy your stupid car.
You all have a lot of baggage.
Yeah, I do like how trusting he is, though, that DiCarlo is like, yeah, just Venmo me. There's no chance that Larry knows how to Venmo. We know this because Larry recently bragged in real life that he doesn't know how to Uber or order delivery food on his phone. Like, he'll call his daughter, who will have to do it for him from across the country, so to use all these apps. So, yeah, Larry doesn't know how to Venmo. Also, Larry apparently doesn't need the title for this car. He can just drive away without signing anything or, you know, anyway. Yeah, but so he leaves, takes the car, goes to buy his cheese, which we, the camera focuses on as he sticks it in the back seat, making it very obvious it'll be forgotten here, to create an odor. Way too obvious, I think, the way they do it. And like, why would Larry put the cheese there instead of in the front seat next to him? Isn't that the
one? Yeah, it place? Made no sense that he puts it in the back. No sense at all.
And I was thinking, well, he doesn't want it in the sun, but then, okay, put it down at the feet of the front seat, not the back seat. So, but again, we need to establish that the cheese has been put there and will be forgotten. And so that is what we have.
Right. Yeah. So we see Lewis come up by, you know, wherever Larry is, and he sees him with the car and he's like, what the hell? What are you doing with that car? You stole my car. That's my car. And Larry's like, he explains the whole situation. Like, I don't even really want this car. I just bought it from him because I felt bad about the whole colostomy bag thing. Like, you can have the car. I'll sell it to you. And Lewis is like, fine, but I want a $3,000 smell discount. And Larry's like, but I paid full price. And he's like, fine. He gives it to Larry. He gets like completely beat over by everybody. His only condition is you need to drive me back to DiCarlo's to pick it up. That's worth $3,000. He's like, I'll give you a $3,000 discount rather than spend an $8 Uber.
Yeah.
So okay. So I think.
And then Richard uses a babe.
Yeah. So Larry goes back now to his lawyer's office, and he arrives at the garage again, and he wants to plug in his electric car into the port. And he.
Wait, hold on. But before we get there, can I just first of all. We get no Leon in this episode. Like, Leon is great in this one little scene we get here for him about the car.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
you're right. I did gloss over that. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's very little Leon, unfortunately. The other thing confusing to me about that scene is, why is Richard's default position to be mad at Larry here? Seeing the car shouldn't have been like, oh, look at this. What a great friend. You bought the car for me. Like, why did he assume his initial assumption was Larry was trying to screw him? Like, he knows Larry doesn't care about this car. Right. So,
I guess, if you're excited about a car, you call your friend to come, like, check it out for you and confirm that you think this is a good car. He basically quashes the deal. He says, no, don't buy this car. And then the next day you see him with the car, your instinct might be like, what the hell? Like, you tricked me just because you wanted the car.
But then when Larry tries to explain, no, I had to get it, but I'm going to give it to you. Larry, he's like, I don't give a shit about that story. Just give me the fucking car. I don't know. It seemed weird. In another Dr. Jen fact check, I asked her, can you get surgery for smell in Switzerland the way Richard claims here? Jen said it depends, but she sounded very skeptical. So I think Richard might be lying.
Yeah, he might be.
All right, so now let's go to the garage where we see this douchebag Victor. Although as terrible as he is, he's such a tosser. Did get a strong LOL for me. I thought it was funny.
Yeah. So Larry, you know, sees him and he goes out of the way to do a big shot toss right in front of him.
while Victor watches on. And
but only because Rodrigo enjoys it so.
Yes. Yeah. So Larry goes up to the lawyer's office and he's getting the feedback from the jury, and it's not good. The word repugnant keeps coming up.
Yeah.
This is the very word that also came up when John Hamm got his focus group on the Larry character. Yeah.
Yeah. Had to be canceled. It is a good line from Sean Hayes, though, when Larry tries to reference 12 Angry Men, and Sean Hayes says, "There's one angry man sitting across from me." But Chris decides to argue with Larry and to bring up many examples of how Larry's being repugnant, being such an asshole. And one example he cites is the cheese story. And I am completely befuddled by how insane Chris Mantle is that he thinks that Larry is the bad guy in the cheese story. What is he talking about? It's complete insanity.
Yeah. So Larry tells him, "That's it. I'm done with you. I'm going to find a lawyer who sides with me on all matters, including cheese and keys."
Yes. You have an issue with keys and cheese. I thought a very corny line by Sean Hayes. Undo the funniness of the angry man line. Yeah. But yes, I do love that Larry finally fires his competent lawyer. Not when he fucked everything up in his actual court case. Not when he was filing deadlines. Right. But when he took the wrong position on cheese, which is also a fireable offense, to be clear. So.
Yeah, especially since you should just take your lawyer's side. I mean, take your client's side.
Yeah. As he leaves, he's getting a text message, and I went to the phone again. The text message is from Jeff's lawyer. That's how it could be in Larry's phone. I'm just surprised that Jeff's lawyer's main form of communication with Larry is SMS. And also why Larry's copy of the original is being sent to Jeff's house, since this text message is going to Larry, not to Jeff. But yeah. Anyway. So we get down to the garage, and we see that the plug has indeed been pulled. I don't understand how Victor would not be immediately fired for this.
Yeah, this is a very below the belt move. And his car is now dying. Yeah.
Bad on Larry to have his car on zero in the first place. I'm not sure why he did that. But whatever. They went for a pull.
It was on zero. I think it was on 15% or 10% when he.
It was on low enough that he couldn't make the drive home. So bad job on him.
So he's frantically trying to call Jeff while he's driving. His car is slowly running out of juice, and he stops right in front of a house that turns out to be Conan's house.
We just establish that Conan lives in the neighborhood around the corner in that new house on the circle?
Yeah, but I guess I didn't realize that was the house. I don't know. Yeah.
No, I don't mean, but I'm saying if Larry is at Conan's house, he doesn't need to start. He can just run home. You don't need to approach Conan. Why does he approach Conan through the window, by the way, instead of the front door? That's also insane.
But does he have another car at home? He needs to go to Jeff's house.
That is true. Oh, yes. He's not trying to get to his house. Yeah. Okay. Good point.
Yeah. But he can also take an Uber.
Yeah. It also doesn't answer why he knocked on the window. But yeah. He doesn't know how to take an Uber. He's got to call his daughter, and his daughter doesn't exist at the show.
Right.
So he's got to ask Conan.
So Conan, hears the story. He's like, "I don't really know these people, but it sounds really serious." Larry's like, "Yeah, trust me, this woman, you can't even imagine the damage she can do." And Conan agrees to lend Larry the car. But as he's going to make good on his favor, he tells Larry about a stain on his glasses and then tosses the car keys. Larry is caught off guard and the keys hit him in the eye. No lessons learned.
A little bit of a triggering scene for some, but then we get to the next scene where they're signing the documents, and both Larry and Jeff have eye patches. So are we supposed to assume that Susie poked him in the eye as punishment?
I wouldn't say poked. I think she probably punched him in the eye.
Well, a punch in the eye doesn't necessarily need a patch. That'd be I don't know. Anyways.
Yeah. I think he probably got a black eye.
Yeah. Well, but you don't have a patch for black eye. You have a patch for damage to the actual.
She poked him in the eye. I think she hit him.
Yeah, Three Stooges style. Anyway, yeah. So, but there's something implied, not really shown. A little strange to me. And also, why does Larry have to sign the documents transferring the power of attorney to Susie when Susie didn't have to sign them transferring it to him? Because if you notice in this scene, Larry signing and then Jeff signing, Susie actually doesn't sign at all. She just is supervising. So, as you can tell, I'm a little disappointed with the scene. And then we get to Richard Lewis driving, And I gotta say, and this will be the final scene in the episode. I gotta say,
well, first we got the text that he did not have a colostomy bag.
Yes, exactly. So it was all for naught. Yeah, and that text, by the way, yes, the only that's the third text in the chain from the first two from that other day. But it's possible they had a phone conversation in the middle or something. That's fine. But yeah, Richard in that car, the effects out the window when he's sitting in the car were just like very cheap and fake and disappointing to me. Like, he's very obviously not driving. It was like Seinfeld-esque, and Seinfeld was, you know, 35 years ago at this point.
Right. So Lewis is going on a date, and we cut home to Larry, who is looking for his cheese, and he flashes back and remembers that he left it in the back of the Mercedes, which makes him very, very happy, because we cut to the very, very end. And Lewis arrives to pick up his very hot date, and she gets into the car, and she smells something very, very bad.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the episode.
There is something sweet about Richard still going on first dates at his age, you know?
Yeah, she might be the one.
Like, yeah, if I were to be that old and that sick and that single, would I be so motivated? I hope so.
That's
so
single.
Well, I mean, I hope not to be single at that age, but well, anyway.
I think it's binary.
Yes. It's also kind of weird to sit in the car and not go to the door. But, you know, again, we know that Richard has to stay seated, unfortunately, for scenes. Kind of mean of her to just storm out like that, though, right? Like, I mean, how bad must it smell?
It must smell really bad. I mean, there's like cheese in the L.A. sun in there for a couple of days at this point.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, must have been something really bad. All right, well, I've... How do you rank this episode?
I rank this episode not that highly, unfortunately. I really thought there was just like a lot of nonsense, and the payoffs I thought were not that great. I thought this was kind of a waste of Conan. Like, I don't really get that storyline at all.
Sure.
The cheese thing was kind of nuts. The whole thing with the keys I thought was kind of silly. Like, I didn't like you want to be able to see both sides. Like, I just like didn't see both sides to a lot of these storylines in this episode, and I didn't think any of them really made me laugh so much either. So, like, you know, I could sometimes overlook the logic if I'm like laughing my ass off, and I just like didn't think this episode delivered in either regard. I will say that this episode is pretty good. Two pretties.
Yeah, I'm in the same place as you. It was going to be impossible to follow last week's episode, which, as I made abundantly clear, you know, I thought was an all-timer. But yeah, it's an uneven episode for the reasons that I've stated throughout the podcast. I'm going to give it two pretties as well, just like you. I rank it 104th overall, right in between Atlanta and The Lawn Jockey, the first two episodes of the season. So after a strong run in LA, even the hint of going back to Atlanta, I guess, has scared me, as my rankings have dropped a lot. Come with guy.
Oh, come on. Be a come with guy.
I said it earlier in the episode, but I'm going to stick with it. To me, the come with guy has to be Larry, just because... Yeah. You know, there's no reason for him to be doing this for Jeff or for Richard. It's the show ending and reminding us that he's a Hall of Fame come with guy. And so that's me. What about you?
Yeah, I had Larry also. I think he buys the car. He then sells it to Richard. Like, he loses money on the transaction. He's driving people all over. He's trying to save his buddy's ass with the power of attorney. He's hitting it off with the valet. He's having a lot of fun this episode, and I think he gets a raw deal from a lot of people. I don't think he does anything wrong here.
Yeah, this is a very big deal. This is the first time in the history of Curb Your Enthusiasm that both you and I have named Larry David the come with guy of an episode.
Oh wow! All right, well, couldn't come too soon.
Yeah, this is actually the third consecutive episode that I've named Larry my come with guy. I gave him one in season 11, one in season 10. You hadn't done it since season 9. In the early years, it was mostly you who did it. And so now a total of 16 nominations for Larry, breaking his tie with Leon. He's in second place all time behind only Jeff. And if you and I both name Larry the come with guy of each of the final two episodes, he would tie Jeff for first all time. So unlikely, but mathematically possible. Jeff has not clinched that division just yet.
You're a fucking asshole. That's what you are.
Who is the fucking asshole?
The fucking asshole here has got to be Susie. First of all, the fact that, like, your husband, like, wants to switch powers of attorney to someone else because he thinks that you're going to kill him is, like, some fucking asshole energy there. But like, that's the least of it. That's like a small thing. Her position with the cheese here is just like unfathomable. It's like one thing, like you take a little bit, like you wanted to sample it. Like that's like a reasonable fee for storing the cheese, like for a friend or whatever. I tried a little bit. Even that is like, you know, I might not be like, it's like in a package. Like the, like,
yeah, if the cheese is half empty, taking a little bite is one thing, but to break the seal on the cheese, no, you can't do that.
And devour the whole thing.
Yeah.
Just completely crazy behavior. Yeah. Fucking asshole behavior for me.
Yeah. It is hard to argue with that, but to me, the fucking asshole has to be our friend Victor. You know, I mentioned the Oyster Shucker, the Tombstone Maker before. Like, those people had some basis for thinking that Larry had wronged them, even if it was mostly unreasonable. Victor has nothing. Larry has never tossed to him. Larry has only tossed to a guy who welcomed and enjoyed the tosses. What is actually going on here is Victor is a loser, is an incel, looking on in rage at Rodrigo and Larry having the time of their life tossing back and forth as buddies. Victor is left all alone to pull the plug on people's cars, thus spoiling their anti-Susie schemes. This guy's a fucking asshole and a loser. And Victor, you're the worst. So I give it to Victor. But Susie always is a fucking asshole. So well earned there as well. And Av, is it time for the postman?
It is time for the postman.
Postman! Postman, come here! Tell the neighborhood! Right, what a shunder, Larry! Larry David! Okay. You're a lousy Jew! But you're a lousy human being! He screws the wife of a man in a wheelchair! A shunder!
Maybe you should have given me some candy!
You're a lousy Jew!
And first off this week, we have a new postman writer. Someone by the name of Salvatore Martello, who says, Av and Alex, love the podcast. First time writing in. Found your podcast a little late in the game, but already a big fan. Being from New York, there's just something I love about listening to Jews talking about random things. Hence my love for a curb. I will say Salvatore Martello doesn't necessarily sound like a member of the tribe.
Yeah, I like listening to Italians talk about random things also.
Yeah. Really enjoyed this episode. Conan and Buscemi appearances were great, and lately Susie has me laughing at her lines in ways I haven't since early on in the series. Between last week's Farbissin upon him and this week's comment about Jeff eating the salad and frickin' frack, Esmond's subtlety is as funny as her outbursts. Coden was great in his role too. The lines about the Titanic, Fatty Arbuckle, and Margaret Dumont killed me. He, of course, is my come with guy. The fact that he still entertains Larry throughout multiple unclear conversations and lets him borrow his car shows his character. My fucking asshole is Victor the valet. He wrongly states that there are only two people in the valet world. He has hand or tossed her confusion for esteemed disdain. Larry was being jovial and playful, not disrespectful, and none of the other valets took issue with the toss. Plus, Larry tipped each time. You can be as big an asshole as you want as long as you tip well. He definitely had it out for poor Larry, sabotaging the jury and unplugging his car. Get a life, dude.
Yep, agree with Salvatore here. By the way, I did look up Margaret Dumont. She was an actress, best remembered as the comic foil to the Marx Brothers in seven of their films. No interactions with Fatty Arbuckle that I can see. But yeah, she was in Duck Soup, a bunch of other stuff.
He says he did think it was funny, though, that he kept calling Larry a tosser, since that's how British people will call you an asshole.
Yeah.
I really like this episode, but I have to give it 3.5 pretties. Laughed a lot, but I feel like there could have been more to this episode. It fell short. Okay. Kenny Eisman says, as JG said in the chat, this did seem like a throwback episode. There were some great bits and themes that could have been from other seasons. I wonder if Larry realized one episode after he's almost stuck with the human cat, he accepts Jeff's offer for power of attorney. A camera shot of...
I forgot about the human cat.
Yeah.
So good.
That camera shot of them signing at the end was fantastic. Firstly, Susie shouts out the word Megillah on Purim was great.
Yeah.
Call back to the I Like It Gambit was so funny, and we even got an Asian actor who spoke without an accent. Needing clearance was such a good point and a great shtick. A little late on all the COVID humor, but I'll take it. If I had to pick one bone, it would be instead of flashing back to Larry leaving the cheese in the car, I would have loved to have ended the episode with a camera shot of it being left in the car. Susie is the fucking asshole of the episode by stealing the cheese, and Mantle for agreeing. She literally agreed to it the day before. Larry is the come-with guy for tipping generously along with Richard to buy the car, buying the car to feel bad for DiCarlo, and buying Jeff a salad to keep him healthy. 4 pretties.
Hmm.
Okay, now for the counterpoint. Mike Christensen says, after the first scene, I was really thinking this episode was back in Atlanta, because boy, was this a stinker. Don't think I laughed. Don't think I laughed once. One pretty. After hearing Roger talk last week about Richard not even being able to stand, it became really apparent watching that every scene with him was staged so he could be sitting in a car. Honestly, it made all those scenes more sad to watch than anything else.
Yep.
Okay. For someone who's a little bit higher, we go to Fitzy. Firstly, I've never been more petrified to listen to an episode of this podcast than I was last week's Postman, given that I wrote in that I didn't like the episode and had no idea there'd be a guest who'd hear it. But hey, at least I was honest about how I felt instead of blowing smoke up her ass or something. Anyway, on to this week's episode. This was a perfect episode of Curb.
What?
Perfect jokes, perfect payoffs, perfect cameos, no notes. Five pretties.
Wow. No,
fucking asshole is the valet juror who called Larry a tosser and unplugged his car. Come with guy is Conan O'Brien. You give me Conan. Conan gets a point. That's how we Irish stick together.
Hmm. Yeah, I do love Conan.
Yeah. No, Conan's great. Okay. Jack Small says,
he's got a new show coming on Max. Curb will end on April 7th. And then just 11 days later, Conan O'Brien Must Go is a new travel show that he has coming on Max. And his when he travels to other countries, those are like my favorite episodes ever. Those his remotes are always good, but especially in other countries, every country's been to it. They're amazing. So I'm super excited for that show.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do that podcast. Probably not.
Yeah, probably not. Jack Small says, this episode's feels like a return to form after what I felt was a lackluster showing from the Dream Scheme.
Wow.
Although I will say, after listening to the podcast, I retroactively upped my rating from 2.5 to 3 pretties. I thought the colostomy bag was a great episode. All the main storylines and bits were funny, and I think the show did a great job of the classic Curb convergence at the end with the cheese in the car. It was great to see Mantle return as Larry's lawyer, although a bit surprising given the state of the relationship at the end of Fish Stuck. And I love the part where Larry can't help himself but to ask what last name they gave their child, and again recommending Ziggy Zekelman. My favorite storyline of the episode was Larry and Jeff's side quest to grant Larry medical POA rights. Especially hilarious was the moment where the episode cuts from Larry's interaction with Conan to the lawyer's office where Larry and Jeff sit in defeat as soon as he signs the new POA. The old Mercedes storyline with Steve Buscemi was also great. Side note, Buscemi looks rough, and ironically, I thought Lewis looked a lot less ghostly in this episode. Lastly, while I didn't really understand the clearance thing with Lewis and Conan, I thought it culminated in one of the best scenes of the episode where Larry's car dies very conveniently outside of Conan's home. Question, do we think Conan intentionally hit Larry in the face or was this an innocent toss? I think innocent toss.
He said, yeah, it'd be pretty devious to say, hey, take off your glasses.
Right. Yeah. He says the episode is pretty good. As I opined about above, I really like this episode. Just felt like really solid Curb. Come with guy. I think I'm going to have to give the come with guy honor to Larry this week. Nobody else particularly stood out. He quite literally came with Richard to buy the car and with Jeff to the lawyer. Also, I'm firmly on Larry's side of the cheese debate. So by default, I couldn't give this award to Jeff or Susie. Fucking asshole. Honorable mention to Jeff and Susie for eating the cheese. That's an insane thing to do. He very clearly stated that he would be back for the cheese tomorrow. Temporary storage, which he got permission for, does not equal transfer of ownership. Anyway, the actual fucking asshole is the valet. You know the one I'm talking about. Who doesn't like a catch? Also, if I'm remembering correctly, I don't think this particular valet was ever the victim of a toss himself. He was getting mad on behalf of his coworkers. Correct. It seemed like the other valets were perfectly fine being on the receiving end of a toss.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they were saying other things behind closed doors, the asshole valet had no right to unplug Larry's car. Even if that were the case, that's an insane thing to do. Larry could probably easily get him fired for that. Well, gentlemen, we've come into the home stretch. Only 2 weeks left. Here's hoping the season finishes strong. Hear, hear.
I do love the strong divergence of opinions we're getting on these episodes. Credit to the episode that some people can love and hate, you know.
It's a credit to the episode episodes. That some people hate it.
No, I'm just saying that people have such different perspectives on it. It leads to more conversation, I think, than if everybody's in complete lockstep.
Nobody knew comedy could be so subjective.
Yeah.
Alex Orvitz says, after the high highs of the last few episodes, this week's was just okay. I don't think there was really a single super memorable thing apart from Conan. I didn't dislike anything, though. Pretty good. 2.5. Come with guy is Conan, who agrees to help Larry even though Larry has no clearance. And LD can't even be mad about the key toss. Fucking asshole is Jeff's lawyer, who won't give Larry the nice pen and sends the papers to Jeff's for Susie to find. Jim Crumley says that the colostomy bag was another solid episode after the disappointment of last week. Each plot was both good and funny, and they all hung together. The big downside this week was how old all the main cast and most of the guest stars felt. Something about seeing Conan and Steve Buscemi looking their ages made the ages of everyone else more noticeable, too. I'm sure it won't end well, but I was glad that Larry fired Mr. Mantle. He couldn't get Larry to listen to reasonable advice about the case or get Larry to like him, so what good is he? I hope that DiCarlo comes back because his scenes were the highlight of the episode. Four pretties. A question for you. What do you think happened in the deleted scene that got Jeff the eye patch? Did Larry throw some keys or cheese? Did Susie punch? I think Susie punched him. I don't think there's any other explanation.
Yeah, I think Susie poked him in the eyeball.
Okay.
She threw something sharp at him.
Okay, fair.
But yeah.
Okay, come with guy, he says Conan. He lent Larry's car despite Larry's constant etiquette breaches. And the fucking asshole is the picky valet. I can see being mildly annoyed by the key toss, but that has to rank low on the list of valet customer faux pas. Okay, starting to wind things down with Zach Brooks, who says he thought this was a great episode. Love the cameos and super weird Conan behavior. Even though I saw the stinky cheese left in the stinky car ending coming a mile away, it still cracked me up. I appreciate that frickin' frack each had one eye messed up by the ends. Come with guy is Rodrigo, the toss-friendly valet. People do love to toss and catch. Fucking asshole was going to be the greens for eating the cheese, but it has to be the valet who pulled the plug. Abhorrent behavior, and he should be fired. 4.5 pretties. Great episode. Which brings us to Olin Allen, who says another husband and wife duo right at the end of this episode.
Who's the husband and wife we got?
Is that woman married to Richard Lewis?
Oh, it's Joyce Lipinski.
Okay. Who's she married to?
Richard
Lewis's wife. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, look at that. Oh, amazing. Oh, that's right, sweet. That his final date on the show is his real wife.
Yeah,
I guess. Oh, in fact, she's in the credits as Joyce Lipinski Lewis. So,
there you go.
That's sweet.
Yeah. I guess that's also part of the joke, right? Is that this unattainable hot woman is his real life wife? Yeah,
I guess so. But it was the one. He was right.
He was right.
See, kids never
grow up. No, that's true. That's true. So he does find the one. Lewis was great fun as always, and Conan Buscemi, great fun too. Buscemi's a great character actor and perfect to play a character rather than himself, no matter how famous he be. Feel Susie is a bit too erratic and soft this season. I mean, is she so soft on Jeff to let him want sandwiches with rich cheese, or is she punishing him with salads before trying to kill him with carbs and rich foods? Love all the old-time film acts with the admittedly as a much more Estonia headache guy when it comes to ice skating film stars of the 20s and 30s. Uh-huh. For his rating, he says a bright and breezy 3.5. Come with guy is Conan giving his car away, and I love someone to chat about Margaret Dumont and Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle with, and he is a great tosser. Fucking asshole is the valet juror. He wasn't being tossed at, and his colleagues like it. Sure, the jury swaying is okay, but unhooking an electric charge is a major asshole move. And we finally end off with John Gormley, who says, this was a top-shelf level episode of Curb, and I declare best of the season, without a doubt.
Without a doubt?
Without a doubt.
And on this topic, there can be no debate.
No unnecessary scenes anywhere. Solid half hour of entertainment focused on about three or four niche plot, not overdone, cheesy, or beyond the unrealistic at any point. Feels like a season two or three episode in that regard. Richard was very funny in all scenes, his best episode since the Honey Parade in season 9. His face in the ending scene as he mindlessly lost the one was the biggest laugh of the episode. A perfect Curb app always has lots of laughs throughout. Then the biggest laugh at the end was two or more things unexpected tying together. Richard desperately trying to stiffen the car to see what was wrong was fantastic. Conan's bits were excellent. Most celebrities get a kick out of playing a grumpier, fictionalized version of themselves on Curb. As Conan is widely regarded as a forthcoming nice guy who will spend plenty of time chatting with random people on the street in real life, from what I've heard, never met him, makes this caricature of him even funnier. Everything dominoed perfectly in this episode, originating from the funky toss, leading to two great scenes with Larry racing his low-car battery and the clever shot of Larry and Jeff both having eye patches. No other way to put this than pretty, 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 pretty good. Come with guy is Rodrigo for encouraging the toss, fucking asshole is Susie for eating Larry's cheese, making Jeff eat a salad, and trying her shot at killing him again. Great episode. Doubt will be topped by either of the final two, but delighted that we got it.
Wow. Okay, well, Av, we got some real divergence in the listener rankings there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how official any of these rankings really are.
So where does that put our cumulative ranking?
Yeah, so our listener ranking, as you said, was kind of all over the place. We had a couple fives, a couple fours, a three, a one, a two. It averages out to a 3.7. So that is the 36th overall episode for the audience. So it's still very, very strong. You gave it a two. I gave it a two. That's going to do some damage. That knocks it all the way down to a 2.57, making it the 101st ranked episode out of 119. So we didn't really love the episode. And for us, it's a bottom 20 episode. So that's where it's going to fall, notwithstanding the strong audience support.
Sorry, listeners.
Don't you hate to be continued on TV? I mean, the whole reason you watch a TV show is because it ends. If I wanted a long, boring story with no point to it, I have my life.
Next week, we get an episode called Ken / Kendra. Did you notice a lot of men dressed as Ken on Perm this year?
Not really, actually. I would have thought more.
Oh, yeah. I felt like there was at least a half dozen guys I knew, like adult men I knew. Not a lot of young kids dressed as Ken.
Yeah, I don't think I saw any. I thought it would be a very popular costume, but I didn't see it at all, really, actually.
All right, okay. So let's watch the trailer for Klaus Be Back here.
Yes.
What are you doing?
I gotta zip up before I go out.
What are you, 6 years old? You can't do your fucking zipper?
All right, I'm going. Oh, hey. Got it.
Good boy.
Drop dead. I got news for you. Susie's got COVID.
Oh, my God.
Susie's stuck upstairs. I got the whole first floor to myself. Oh, it's a dream. It's Jet World down here.
Larry.
Hey, Les.
I'm in talks about this Waze app feature.
A movie based on the Waze app?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like a good idea.
No, not really.
All right, Matt Berry.
Oh, who's Matt Berry?
He's from that vampire show.
Okay, because they called him Les, and I wasn't sure who this person was, if it was a famous person playing themselves or not, like a movie director or something from some, you know, superhero movies. A movie about Waze. What do you think about that, Off, as a plot for a movie?
Sounds terrible.
Yeah. The zipper thing, I have it's actually a brown leather jacket. It's sort of Conan-esque. That I really like a lot, but it's really hard to do the zipper. And so I'll always sort of look like a 6-year-old child really struggling with my zipper before I go outside when I wear it in like the fall and spring. So I associate with Larry there. And then this Jeff World idea, a great idea, but a little bit past its point. You know, it's an expiration point at this point, right?
The COVID part hopefully will be irrelevant. Like it could be the flu and the same situation applies.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, except I guess you don't really aware. Like,
right. You don't have to quarantine for.
Yeah. I mean, I got COVID in Miami in January of 2021, and I got it the morning we got there, and it was great because I had to be quarantined in my one little room, which was Alex World, and I couldn't see anyone in my family all day Sunday, and they all got it anyways. And then for Sunday of the divisional championship of the playoffs, I think I got to watch all the football completely uninterrupted with no obligations. So that was fun. Every time there's a big play, my son would run to the door and bang it on the other side. Ah, but did you see that? So, Jeff World. I'm looking forward to Jeff World. I bet Jeff will have a lot of fun in Jeff World because you know what they don't have in Jeff World? Susie. So,
Jeff World so sounds. Pretty
good. Get a life, Jews.